Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
E is equal mc squared, in which energy is
all spent for man.
The human genome is our shared inheritance.
And it is sitting at property.
Cricks and cracks.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. As regular listeners know, we tackle some pretty weighty matters on this program. Cloning, genetically modified organisms, stem cells, nuclear energy, the origins of life in the universe. Yes, we've dared to tread down all those paths. But today we have a truly brave scientist on the show. A scientist who's tackled and solved one of the enduring mysteries of the natural world. How do certain turtles turn themselves over after tipping onto their backs? If you knew that the answer lies in geometry, then give yourself a prize. But it's not all serious stuff like turtle tipping on today's program. We'll also learn about the world's flattest battery, made on a sheet of paper. Plus, we'll visit a Canadian museum that has the world's oldest reptile footprints and discover how some monkeys like to talk baby talk to their young. But we begin with some truly chilling news about global warming. This is Quirks and Quarks. We're not getting very much good news on climate change these days. Arctic sea ice is disappearing faster than predicted. And as you heard on our program recently, northern permafrost is melting away at an increasing rate. Greenland's huge ice cap may also be melting faster than scientists had anticipated. And on top of that, we seem to be experiencing the weather disasters that scientists predicted we'd see as our climate changes, like droughts and this week's wildfires in California. All this, of course, is connected to the greenhouse gases we've been pumping into the atmosphere. Now we've just been given the bad news that we're releasing those gases faster than scientists anticipated. A report published this week revealed that the rate of CO2 emissions is accelerating. In more ways than one, we've got our foot on the greenhouse gas pedal. Dr. Chris Field is director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University and was one of the authors of the report. Dr. Field, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me what you and your colleagues have found.
What we did in this study is we looked at the scenarios that have been used by the IPCC in order to provide starting conditions for the climate models. And these scenarios represent a range of different futures. Some are highly globalized, some are highly localized. Some have an emphasis on fossil fuels, some have an emphasis on information technology. So there's a range of these things. And nobody's saying that they know what way the world is going to go. But what we would hope is that as we move into the future, the actual emissions would be somewhere within this range. But what we've seen is that actual emissions rapidly after these scenario started, which was 2000, rapidly climbed to the very upper edge of the range. And for the last few years, they actually have been substantially above the entire range of scenarios that the IPCC's used. Whether or not these super high emissions can be sustained, nobody really knows. But it is not a good sign that the actual emissions are outside this range that we've used as our sort of set point for the best case and the worst case for looking at the future.
So we're beyond the worst case scenario already.
We're working outside the range to the direction of being worse than the worst-case scenario. That's correct.
Now, how much higher was that than what was predicted?
What we found is that three factors are contributing to the accelerating rate of atmospheric CO2 growth, and each of the factors is outside the range of predictions. The first is that global economic activity has been expanding really rapidly. The second is that, in contrast to expectations, it's taking us more carbon rather than less carbon to produce each unit of economic activity. And the third is we're seeing that the processes in the ocean and on land that are taking up some of the CO2 that's released from industrial activity are not working as well as they used to, that their efficiency is going down.
Well, let's take these one at a time then, relating to the economic growth. Tell me there.
When we project CO2 emissions going into the future, there's an underlying model about economic activity and population, and the range of estimates that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change uses to fuel the climate models goes from modest economic growth to rapid economic growth. But none of the scenarios that we've been using have envisioned anything like the almost 10% per year economic growth that we're seeing in China and India and in other parts of the developing world. Basically, economic activity is driving us much faster than we expected in any of the scenarios, so that we're actually releasing substantially more CO2 from industrial activity than we expected in even the worst case or the most pessimistic of the CO2 emission scenarios. But on the other hand, you can view that as an optimistic economic scenario. So it's a two-edged sword.
Well, it's good economically, but where is this growth happening, and how is it increasing the emissions?
Much of the recent growth has been based on coal-fired power plants. So we're seeing a big increase in economic activity requiring a lot more energy, but we're also seeing that being powered by the most carbon-intensive of the energy sources. A lot of this growth is happening in Eastern Asia, in China and India, but what we're seeing is that no parts of the world are really decreasing their emissions. When we look at, for example, the Kyoto Protocol, that's asking for emissions reductions in the world's industrialized countries. None of those have been reducing, and in fact, the total amount of CO2 emissions from industrial activity in 2006 was 35% above the level in 1990. Remember, what the Kyoto Protocol calls for is the world's industrialized countries to get to 5% below 1990 by the 28 to 2012 commitment period.
You mentioned carbon intensity. What do you mean by that?
We think of carbon emissions to the atmosphere as being described by carbon intensity of the economic activity, carbon per dollar of economic activity. Over the last several decades, carbon intensity of the world economy has gone down very consistently. It's improved. It takes less and less carbon to produce a dollar of economic activity. But since 2000, that improvement in economic activity has stalled, and it's taking us more carbon to produce each new dollar of economic activity. We had been in a long period where we were pushing more and more of the energy system toward natural gas, where more and more of the economic activity was not heavy manufacturing, where it was things like information technology, financial services, stuff like that. And what's happened is that a lot of the new economic activity is heavy manufacturing, and it's heavy manufacturing that's powered by the most polluting of the energy sources, carbon from coal-fired power plants. One of the things that's clear in all of these scenarios that we've used to describe the future is that the expectation is that this carbon intensity would continue to improve. It would continue to go down as we use less and less carbon per unit of economic activity. So it's a big surprise, and it's outside the range of the estimates we've been using, that this improvement has either stalled or gone away and is back toward going up.
Now, you also mentioned there's another factor here, which is the nature's ability to absorb carbon dioxide. Take me there.
That's right. Throughout the last 50 years or so, human activities have received what I think of as a huge subsidy from nature. For every ton of carbon dioxide that's been emitted to the atmosphere, only about 40% of it has stayed there, and the other 60% roughly has been taken up, at least temporarily, by processes in the land, uptake by plants and soils, and processes in the ocean, where the CO2 essentially goes into solution in the oceans. And what we're seeing is that airborne fraction, the approximately 40% that stays in the atmosphere, is gradually increasing. It's up to almost 45% now as a result of a decrease in the efficiency of these uptake processes on the land and in the oceans. And in particular, what we're seeing is that the processes in the ocean that take up carbon dioxide seem to be decreasing in efficiency, especially the processes that operate near Antarctica.
Well, let's take first in the land. What's happening there that's decreasing the amount of carbon dioxide that's being absorbed?
Well, year-to-year uptake of carbon dioxide by land is highly variable. It depends a lot on specific environmental conditions, droughts, wildfires, insect outbreaks. All those things can result in carbon releases. Good weather, high rainfall can result in carbon uptake. we're not seeing clear evidence of a decrease in uptake on the land, but we're also not seeing that uptake increase. And the reason we think we're not seeing it increase is that there have been a series of quite profound droughts over the last 7 or 8 years that have affected many parts of the Northern Hemisphere, including North America, Europe, and Asia.
Okay, that's the land. Now, you also mentioned the oceans. What's happening there?
Well, we think the main thing that's happening in the oceans is that a change in winds and high latitudes in the Southern Hemisphere near Antarctica that's related to global warming has resulted in the surface waters having higher CO2 concentrations than they did previously. Essentially, what's happened is that the winds are stronger near Antarctica, and these stronger winds are basically blowing the low-carbon water off the surface ocean, and they're letting high-carbon water come close to the surface. What this means is that the effective concentration gradient from the atmosphere to the ocean becomes smaller, and less CO2 goes into the ocean as a consequence. We think that this weakening of the high-latitude southern sink has resulted in a decrease in ocean uptake by about 300 million tons of carbon per year.
So the water is essentially already full of carbon dioxide.
Exactly.
Boy. Is it also affecting the circulation within the water itself and how the carbon moves in the water circulation?
Right. So this is basically a consequence of a change in the ocean circulation. The thing that concerns us especially is that this change in the circulation looks like it's related to two human-caused factors. It has a global warming component and it has an ozone hole component. So this is basically the kind of a vicious cycle where warming is causing decrease in the ability of a sink to take up warming, which leaves more CO2 in the atmosphere, which causes more warming. This is exactly what we don't want to see in the climate system.
Boy. Now, we have some control, at least theoretically, over our emissions. We can try to cut those back. But is this carbon sink problem a permanent one?
I think that the most likely outcome here is that the strength of sinks in the ocean and on land will tend to erode gradually as climate warms. I think the big concern in the climate community is that we don't want to let warming get to the point where these sinks erode dramatically or even convert into sources. One of the big concerns, for example, is that carbon locked in permafrost at high latitude may be released to the atmosphere as the climate warms. Another possibility is that wildfires might become important in areas in the tropics where they're not important now, resulting in a large release of carbon to the atmosphere. The way I see it is that our responsibility as societies is to keep climate change to the level where nature can continue to be an ally in this problem and doesn't turn into an enemy.
We seem to be hearing a lot of news indicating that climate change is happening faster than what had been foreseen by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. How concerned are you about that?
Well, one of the things that's extremely important to understand about the way the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change works is that the process is intrinsically very conservative. The role of the IPCC is to synthesize published literature and to present opinions that are well established by the scientific community. That tends to make them very conservative. And it's not surprising, then, that the leading edge of the science is indicating a view that is more nuanced and more rich with new information than the IPCC syntheses.
Well, as someone who's on the leading edge, how concerned are you?
I am very concerned. I think that we are seeing stronger and stronger evidence for a number of these vicious cycle type components. As we move ahead, the impression I get is we're seeing that the vast majority of the new levers we discover are levers that push us toward more rapid and larger climate change rather than the factors that tend to stabilize and minimize the impacts.
Dr. Field, thank you very much.
Been a pleasure to speak with you.
Dr. Chris Field is director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University. His research was published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.